From Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater, this is a special edition of Charlotte Talks in cooperation with the Charlotte Observer. I'm Mike Collins, along with Observer Metro columnist Mark Washburn, and this hour, it is a candidates' forum. Good morning, Mark. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, the leading vote-getters in the Democratic primary for mayor are here this hour. Incumbent mayor and former state senator Dan Clodfelter and former chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission Jennifer Roberts have agreed to meet in advance of next week's runoff. Mark and I will be asking some of our own questions, but most of the questions have come from WFAE listeners, Observer readers, reporters in both of our newsrooms, and from the audience assembled here in the McGlowan Theater. Questions will be directed to individual candidates, sometimes to both, and although we won't be keeping a strict time clock on the answers, we will do our best to balance the amount of time given to each candidate. So Jennifer Roberts and Dan Clodfelter, thank you for being with us this morning.
Always a pleasure.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Even if you're not with us at Spirit Square, you can join us as usual by searching for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or you can use the hashtag CLTDebate, and you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Let's start with this. The Charlotte Observer did not endorse either of you in the original primary. The Observer's editorial board is here this morning. Tell them why they made a mistake. And why they should endorse one or the other of you. And I'll begin with you, Jennifer.
Well, I am running for mayor to help spread opportunity to all corners of our city. And I plan to do that by strengthening our schools and our neighborhoods and by bringing good-paying jobs to Charlotte. And as a wife and mother, I have a unique and important perspective on what it takes to strengthen our schools and to strengthen our neighborhoods. As a former teacher and a former businesswoman, I know that good schools and good jobs go hand in hand. As a former diplomat and someone who works in the international community quite a bit, I know what companies look for when they want to come to Charlotte. I know how to recruit companies. I know how to reach globally because Charlotte's becoming a global city. And I also have worked extensively in the international community here, a growing sector full of energy, and that, again, is going to help bring jobs to every corner of our city.
Dan Clodfelter.
Yeah, I think they may have been a little exasperated with me that in my first months in office, I didn't act like I had been swept in with an overwhelming electoral mandate. And I tried to explain, I think, that the circumstance of the time to me required a little different approach to the job. The community needed something different, and I sensed that the tempo of what it wanted at the time and what it needed at the time was a little different. What I said to the editorial board, I would say again to them now, is that's part of the reason I want to do this again before I hang up my hat, is I want to turn it back that's my own. So I can step out a little bit more and talk about some of the things and some of the challenges we've really got in the community. We're doing reasonably well if you look at things just at a first pass in the community, but there are some very deep challenges in the community that require mobilization of an awful lot of people, an awful lot of different interest groups, an awful lot of resources. That's the kind of skill that I've brought to my public service over 30 years in the city council and in the state legislature. And I think I still have it to try to work on some of those key issues. How we put together a long-term transit funding plan is one of the most important ones. What we do to sort of spread the job growth that we're experiencing all throughout the community and make that available to everyone in the community. And how we rebuild a different kind of partnership with the state government.
Mark, you want to ask a question?
Thank you. Story in the paper today by Jim Morrill. Jennifer Roberts, campaign manager, accused Dan Clodfelter of lying about Jennifer's record in a mailer about education. Clodfelter's communication director said it was Roberts who continues to lie about her record. Neither one of you were quoted in that story. What would you say? Explain this to us. Jennifer, if you would begin.
Well, I think it's important to set the record straight. I am proud of my record on supporting education. And what I found is that if there are inaccurate statements out in the community, unless you respond, people think that they might be true. And I had to correct my record. While I was on the county commission, we increased funding for CMS $89 million and that was about a 33% increase. Even if you look at just my years in the graphic that the Observer actually sent, if you look at just my years as commission chair, we increased funding $17 million. And if you look at the way that the flyer presented the numbers, they actually only added the negatives. And so it's like balancing your checkbook by just adding the checks and not the deposits. And I wanted to correct the record so that people know, and people in the community know, I have been an advocate for education ever since I graduated from East Mecklenburg High. And in all my years on the county commission, in fact, that's the reason that I got into politics in the first place. Every child deserves a great school, and that's what spreads opportunity to every corner of our city.
Mayor?
All of the information in the mailer was drawn directly from published reports from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system, every bit of it. It was fact-checked. It was cross-checked against quotes that were published in the newspaper as well about positions taken on the budget. The important thing to realize is you've got to be careful about how you use budget numbers. There's a capital budget, which generally is the voter-approved bonds for school construction, and then there is the budget that actually funds the education of the kids in the classroom. Those are the expenditures on the teachers, the classroom supplies, the support, and that's what the mailer was talking about. Over the period of those 6 years, there was substantial reduction in per-pupil funding in the classroom. Classroom expenditures on a per-pupil basis fell from approximately $3,076 at the beginning of the time to the end to about $2,300 per pupil. The increases that did occur in funding for the operating budget for the school system occurred in the last fiscal year of the time when there was a change in leadership on the Board of County Commissioners. Every one of the facts was verified and cross-checked. Now, it's an interesting fact to me because Wake County, which is a comparable school district in Mecklenburg County, was experiencing the same stresses during the same period. And the school system and the county up there took a very different approach and did not reduce operating budget expenditures or per-pupil expenditures in the Wake County school system.
Education's kind of become an issue in this campaign, yet the mayor has no effect on what CMS does. Is this just because it's a handy issue? Explain why it's become part of the routine.
Well, I think I have heard this in the community, and if we're talking about spreading opportunity to all corners of our city, that has to start with great schools. But, you know, this reminds me of an issue when I was on the county commission. There was a need for a domestic violence shelter, and it wasn't the county's responsibility because there was a nonprofit running the shelter. And people said it wasn't a priority. When I was on the commission, I made it a priority. We didn't have the money in the county. I went out to the private sector and helped raise $8 million to build that new shelter on West Boulevard. I want to do the same thing for our schools. There was an article today in the paper about how out-of-school time, after-school time, helps strengthen schools by keeping kids on grade level and by keeping them in school with those out-of-school activities. We don't currently have an organization that is monitoring and assessing the gaps we have in out-of-school time and after-school time. I hear this from parents when I'm walking in Hidden Valley and other neighborhoods. They don't have access to after-school programs. I want to go out in the private sector and raise money to build an organization that is going to help train and evaluate after-school programs and assess the gaps and fill them. That's what I plan to do to strengthen schools, and that absolutely was something the mayor can do.
Mayor?
There are ways that the city can be supportive of CMS and the county commission, not by interfering with their work or trying to take over their work, but by trying to supplement and provide additional programming and resources. One of those ways the city is already actively doing and has been doing for a number of years, and that is through annual funding for after-school programs. If you look at the city budget, you'll see over $1 million a year put by the city into after-school programming on a very thoughtful basis. That's a process the city council has been working on for several years. The second thing that we can do, and I think this is something we ought to reexamine, is the funding for the school resource officers that provide support in the school system. There were some changes a few years back in the way those were funded. I think the city could step up and fund a larger share of the school resource budget. The third thing that the city can do to support the school system is to work on the digital divide issues. We have a great opportunity now with companies like Google Fiber and AT&T and others who are coming into the community wanting to put resources into closing the digital divide. We can assist the school system in that because a lot of that is infrastructure-based. The fourth and most important thing a mayor can do is to provide leadership support by being a spokesperson in the community for the difficult tasks that CMS faces right now with the pupil assignment plan. If you look back at the history of this community, the mayors in past years, Mayor Brookshire and other mayors who followed him, spoke openly to the community about the need to get the desegregation issue right in this community. And that's something the mayor needs to step up, and all elected officials, by the way, need to step up now and start giving support to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board as they wrestle with that most difficult challenge. We've got to be sure that...
I want to remind our assembled audience here that we want to take questions from you in every segment of this program. So if you have a question, please step up to one of the microphones in the back of the house and we'll come to you as quickly as we can. And we have a couple of people heading toward those microphones right now, so let me go over here. Welcome, ma'am. Go ahead.
My name is Deb, and I live in Fourth Ward. There's been a lot of apartments built and housing in the Center City, in South End, and in Ballantyne. But what I want to know, and I think this affects the schools.
And the question is?
Where's the workforce housing? And how are you going to spread it around?
Let's begin with Dan Clodfelter.
Okay. Thanks. I wasn't sure who you wanted to go first. Yeah. A lot of our workforce housing in the community right now is in established neighborhoods, and one of the most difficult challenges the city council faces every month on rezonings is the pressure on those neighborhoods to demolish existing affordable housing and replace it with much higher-priced housing. That's a real struggle the council is going through right now. In the past, that's one part of the answer. In the past, when I served on the city council before, the city had a very strong locational policy about providing affordable housing in all parts of the community. Somewhere over the years, the commitment to that policy sort of drifted away, and I have trouble now when I go looking for it, even finding a formal articulation of that policy. I think we need to revisit that issue and reinstate the locational criteria that the city used to have and be a little bit more aggressive about how we apply that.
Jennifer Roberts.
We absolutely have a shortage of affordable housing. The last I heard, it was more than 17,000 units short. And this is for our teachers, our police officers, restaurant workers, and we don't want our workers to have to live in a surrounding county to be able to afford to work in Charlotte. We absolutely need to focus our policy on supporting more affordable housing. We need to look at transit corridors because a lot of folks who ride the bus and use transit don't have driver's licenses, and they have to depend on that to get to work. That's where it makes sense to have some of the apartments, and you'll see that some of that is happening. But we absolutely need to do a better job at making sure that workers in all parts of our city have that access. And that's something that's going to take, again, public-private partnerships to make it happen.
We will start in the next segment with another listener question because we don't have time to take one in this segment at this point in time. And when we come back from the break, we'll also be talking about the economy, the state of the Charlotte economy, and what a mayor can do to improve the health of the economy, among other questions. Reminder that our audience listening on the radio can also get to us through the regular channels at WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or at Charlotte Talks at WFAE, or... you can use the hashtag CLT debate. We'll come right back. Mark Washburn from the Charlotte Observer is with me, and we'll come right back with Jennifer Roberts and Dan Clodfelter in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
You're listening to a debate between the Democratic candidates for mayor, Jennifer Roberts and Dan Clodfelter, live from McGloin Theater in Uptown Charlotte. We'll get back to it in just a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Center City partners, now accepting volunteers for the Novant Health Thanksgiving Day Parade through the Order of the Wishbone Volunteer Program. Details at paradevolunteer.com. And from Griffin Brothers Tire, Wheels, and Auto Repair, family-owned, serving the greater Charlotte area since 1961. 10 convenient locations featuring tire and automotive repair. Details at griffinbrothers.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, aging can come with memory challenges, and we hear about the role diet, exercise, socialization, even delayed retirement may play in preventing dementia and possibly delaying Alzheimer's. That's Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Planned Parenthood's president testifies before Congress on the controversial tapes discussing fetal tissue research, how the political fight over funding Planned Parenthood is drawing attention to the medical uses of fetal tissue.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you today from the McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square. Mark Washburn is joining me from the Charlotte Observer. They and our newsroom have helped put together questions, as have you. And we have questions coming from our audience here at McGlowan for the two candidates in the Democratic runoff for mayor, Jennifer Roberts.
That's okay. You can call me Julia anytime.
Jennifer Roberts and Dan Clodfelter. We're going to go back to the audience for another question. Welcome. Jennifer.
Well, that's actually an issue that's been very near and dear to my heart, and I think that it is something our city should not tolerate, that we have people who are homeless, who don't have a shelter. And I have, when I was a commissioner, we worked very hard to actually bring social services to some of the shelters and some of the supportive housing so that we had counseling. And it wasn't just bricks and mortar, but also people who could help people get on disability, who could help with job searches, who could help with counseling. And that's, you know, we have the city and the county working together better. We can make that happen in a better way. Also, the domestic violence shelter I helped raise money for, that helps some of our families who are struggling. Many of our families who are homeless are suffering from an incident at home, and you know, it could be health care, it could be domestic violence. So that was another thing that I did to try to help relieve that. But we absolutely need to continue to work with places like McCreech Place and Moore Place to expand those opportunities to help get training and counseling to folks who are homeless. We have folks who arrive here from other cities who are fleeing troubles as well. And I will continue to support working to expand that outreach so that we continue to tackle that problem.
Before Dan Clodfelter answers the question, I'm told that our radio audience did not hear the question because the microphone wasn't on to the radio. So the question was, what are you as mayor going to do to end homelessness in Charlotte? Dan Clodfelter.
We've got two current active initiatives. In November of last year, we announced the Mayor's Challenge to End Veterans Homelessness with a goal of having all of our homeless veterans, long-term veterans, who are a large portion of the homeless population in Charlotte, in permanent housing by the end of this year. We went out and did an inventory of who they were, found out where they were, and then began to connect them one at a time with permanent housing and supportive options. We're about, I'd say, about two-thirds of the way there in terms of that population. The second initiative was kicked off at the beginning of this year. Some of you have heard about it. It's called Housing First Charlotte. It's a collaborative of about 40 community organizations plus the city and the county to address the problem, again, of long-term homelessness. The model of Housing First is to say we can't really effectively provide services to homeless people unless we first get them at a place where those services are accessible, where they are safe, and where they can take advantage of those services. The model is a national model. We've adopted it here in Charlotte. It's proven very successful in places like New Orleans. The city's commitment is to provide the actual physical housing and then bring the other partners in the Housing First Initiative into the housing to provide on-site services. I'll tell you what the missing gaps are, the places where we still need to work. We've got two homeless populations that we don't really have good solutions for right now. And that's where our next challenge needs to be, and that is folks who are temporarily housing without housing because they're the victims of human trafficking or because they're having family difficulties, particularly LGBT youth. Those are two populations right now that we need to find new strategies for.
I think Dan Clodfelter, in the primary, both Michael Barnes and David Howard said that you explicitly told them that you would not be running for mayor in the next election when you were appointed. I'm curious as to whether or not you actually told them that, and if so, why? Because here you are. Why did you change your mind?
Well, the answer is no, I didn't tell them that. There was a lot of different opinion on the council about what they wanted me to do and not do. And they never really did come to a consensus. What I feel like has led to this is the lack of closure on getting agreement on that subject. What I actually said was that I don't have any plans right now to run again, and I didn't at the time. I didn't even know what I was getting into fully. I knew something needed to be done. I felt a call to do it. I didn't know whether I'd be any good at it. I didn't know whether I would even like it. And so I didn't go into it with any plan to run again. But I clearly said at the time, I'm going to reassess that question at the end of the year. I may change and have a different approach to it after the end of the year. I want to look back and then see, have I done a decent job? Have I done what you expected? And then I'll decide.
So Charlotte is growing by leaps and bounds, and people come here from all over the country because it's a great place to live, and we love our quality of life. But, of course, you run the risk of killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And particularly in South End, where I think 10,000 new apartment units are going up, and now they're talking about building an office building on the space where the Common Market is and where Food Truck Fridays exist. Well, you can hear the reaction to that right there. So do you see this as a problem? And if so, where do you see Food Truck Friday moving to? Jennifer.
Yes, I think that growth is a challenge. I think that it's a good challenge. We have people who are moving here from all over the country and from all over the world. And they see that Charlotte's a great place to live. We are going to have to continue to work with the community to find how we fit the folks coming here into some of the great things that we have going on without destroying our historic character, without destroying our hospitality, and without knocking the food trucks off the area because they're great. Rumier Bearden Park is a great place, and the 4th of July festival, there were food trucks all over there. That whole park was filled with people. It's tremendous to see how that area of uptown has really become an attraction with the baseball stadium. And so I think that there are definitely, we need to find a place for the food trucks because that's a growing industry, small business, a great opportunity for small women and minority-owned businesses to succeed. And I'm very supportive of finding a place for the food trucks.
Dan?
The planning staff is currently working on a proposed ordinance that would make it easier to provide food trucks, not just in one location, but all across town. Some specific initiatives, though, that are underway right now is one is focused on the old Eastland property. While we're developing a long-term plan for the redevelopment of that property, it's very important that we keep folks engaged in the property. And so we opened, many of you may have seen, we opened a market and with food trucks as well as other vendors out there about 3 or 4 weekends ago. We're also in discussions right now about relocating the farmers market from the very underutilized location right now off of Billy Graham Parkway and maybe putting it on the Eastland site as an interim use until the full development occurs. That'd be a great location. But I really don't think we need to confine it to one location. I'd like to see us develop the ordinance on allowing food truck opportunities all across the city, not just in one place.
Mark.
Should they stay or should they go? As you both know, there are 2 Confederate monuments on city property. If you had to vote this morning, tell me what you'd say. Keep it, move them.
I think Confederate monuments belong in a museum.
Mayor?
I'd vote to move them. Actually, the one on the city property has been moved. It's in warehouse.
Back to the question of economic development. One of the big jobs of the mayor of Charlotte is to go out and bring in new business, as you mentioned. Have either one of you any significant experience in wooing a corporate partner to the city?
Well, for 5 years as county commission chair, that was a big part of my job, and in coordination with the chamber and the city and the state, because there are state incentives as well. But this was during the recession. My first year as chair was great. We got a lot of successes, but then during the recession, it was very hard. So it was a major challenge, but it was also, I think we were very successful in replacing some of the jobs that were being lost. And we had a number of companies, you know, Toshiba, ABB, Electrolux, that did locate here, that grew headquarters. Again, 5,000 new jobs during that time. If you look at before the recession hit, there were more. And I think it's we need to focus on diversifying. We've done a great job of that. We talked about making Charlotte an energy hub. It really has become an energy hub. I think we have great opportunity around big data and IT and making Charlotte more of an innovation city. We have low-cost electricity that helps. We have a lot. We have a great workforce. We have a lot of creativity and arts and sports in the uptown area that continues to be attractive. And I look forward to being our city's salesperson.
But in your own personal job, have you been a key player in any of these negotiations?
Absolutely. In several negotiations of companies that have come to town, as county commission chair, sat down with the chamber on the phone or in person with CEOs and CFOs and talked about what the incentives package looks like, what the clawback provisions mean, what the workforce looks like, how we would partner with Central Piedmont to make sure we had folks trained for that specific company's needs.
Dan?
Yes.
Can you give us an example?
Well, about a week or so ago, I met with a representative of a large Chinese company that's prospecting for locating in North Carolina because they're an equipment supplier to the energy sector. This was their first visit to the United States, and they wanted to sort of meet and talk with some local officials. So, I mean, that sort of thing is fairly common. Up until this year, the county has not had an economic development function, and the current leadership of the county commission has put in place an economic development department, which now partners with the city's economic development office and neighborhood and business services. So we've got a much stronger local base for going after companies than we've had in the past. One of the things that I'm really excited about is the spinoff from the financial services industry and the innovation that's coming out of that. And so last fall, early October, I convened a group of folks working in the so-called fintech space. We probably don't have time to explain what that is, but those are really tech companies that are innovating in financial services, and some of the more traditional corporations in the city to talk about how we could boost that effort, recruit more companies into the market in that fintech sector. We've been meeting quarterly now. Trying to do a survey of the landscape, identify what we need, and identify some targets that we can go out and recruit from Silicon Valley and bring to Charlotte.
I just need to correct something. The county has had an economic development function and has had a professional dedicated to that for years. John Allen was the one who worked with me when I was county commission chair, and Bobby Shields as well. And the county has been intricately involved in discussions for
Dan,
years.
You're shaking your head.
We take a different view of that function.
Okay. I want to go to audience questions in a second, but we have an email from Bill who says, when is it appropriate to forego tax revenue-generating development in order to preserve some open space? Dan?
Well, it's appropriate to do that when you've got the right plan for where you need your open space and what you want to do with it. I mean, that's not a question you decide on an abstract. You decide on concrete cases. One of the things that we've been doing very successfully recent years is using open space to create addresses, to create places. And again, I agree with Commissioner Roberts about this. The use of Bromare Bearden Park as a way of creating an address that fosters development all around the park has been a huge success. We're doing the same thing now in the First Ward Park. And that's going to spawn a very, very active community built around the park as a focus. I think that's going to become much more common in the future than passive parks. For an urban city, those kinds of parks are going to become much more important.
One of the ways that you preserve open space is that you focus on transit corridors and density of development. And the county did a great job of actually buying land in advance of knowing where the parks were going to be and how they were built. We called it land banking because we knew that we were growing community and that those spaces were going to become precious and rare. And I fought very hard to make sure Romer Bearden Park would actually happen, because again, during the recession, there were a lot of spending that was questioned and a lot of challenges. But we have done also a great job of developing greenways, which are linear parks, but tremendous use by the community. In fact, we did a master plan when I was chair that looked at what the community wanted to have nearby. 75% of the people responding to that plan said they wanted to be near a greenway, which is terrific, because young, old, all different folks can use it for different reasons, and it connects our neighborhoods. It's actually a transportation route as well. We've gotten funding from DOT to help expand the greenways.
Let's go back to the audience, and we'll begin on this side of the auditorium. Go ahead, welcome.
I'm George from downtown, and I'm just curious, what unique skills do you believe you possess and or unique experiences you think you've had that differentiate you from your competitor to be more qualified as mayor?
Who would you like to answer that first?
Let's go with Dan.
Okay.
One thing I would call out, mainly because it's right now in my mind this morning because I used it all day yesterday, was my skill at sort of working with our partners and sometimes our problems in Raleigh. That's an increasing challenge for us right now in Charlotte. It's on my mind. That's why I use it as the answer to your question, because I spent most of the day yesterday on the telephone talking to legislators about a piece of legislation that cropped up yesterday morning that would essentially preempt Charlotte's ability to have a minimum housing code, to have anti-discrimination ordinances, or to govern an awful lot of activity in the housing sector. That's a critical skill, and I have been working those relationships pretty actively over the course of the last 18 months. I think going forward, we're going to have to have a new kind of dialogue with the legislature. I have some ideas about how that needs to occur. I have some thoughts about who can help us advance that dialogue at the state level. I think that's an important skill that the city's going to need.
Jennifer, we have less than 90 seconds left. Go
ahead. Great. Okay. I've been a teacher and a county commissioner, and I have direct leadership experience working with schools and understanding how education and workforce training and jobs go together. I also have unique international experience. I have been a diplomat in the Foreign Service. I speak Spanish fluently. I will continue to leverage those partnerships with our international community to make sure that we are spreading opportunity to them, as well as helping our companies here export and continue to grow and bring companies here from around the world. I also have been, as County Commission Chair, a spokesperson for the county at the state level and the federal level. I have been to Raleigh. I have been to Washington. I have advocated for grants for this city and this county, and done that for 5 years, serving on national and state boards. And I think that experience will be tremendous for the job of mayor.
Mark Washburn and I have a few more economic questions coming up. We're also going to talk about the streetcar and toll roads. And Lori on Facebook has a question about the Cherry neighborhood and rezoning. And we have more questions from our audience. We'll start there when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks from the McGlohan Theater with the two Democratic candidates in next week's runoff for mayor, Jennifer Roberts and Dan Clodfelter. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Coming right back to the debate between Jennifer Roberts and Dan Clodfelter, live from McGlohan Theater, this is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Moorcroft Shopping Village at Colony and Sharon Road, and at DonaldHack.com. And from WTVI PBS Charlotte, a part of American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public initiative addressing the dropout crisis made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, October 3rd, 11 a.m. on PBS Charlotte. Up next at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, Planned Parenthood's president testifies before Congress on the controversial videos that feature employees discussing fetal tissue research. We'll look at how the political fight over funding for Planned Parenthood is drawing attention to the medical uses of fetal tissue. That's up next at 10.
New York City provides shelter for tens of thousands of homeless people thanks to a very careful reading of that state's constitution.
You know, at the end of the day, the best argument I had was, Your Honor, the word shall provide emergency shelter means shall. Shall means shall. That's not complicated.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, how a grad student and a lawyer made it happen. The story next time on Marketplace from APN.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Mark Washburn from the Charlotte Observer. We're here with Dan Klotfelter and Jennifer Roberts, the two candidates in the Democratic runoff election next week. We may have more people in the auditorium here at McGlone Theater than will be actually voting, but that's okay. we're going to go back to the audience for some questions, and we'll begin on this side of the house. Welcome.
I'm Jim. I live in Charlotte. Polls show that 94% of us local residents do not want the toll lanes, especially the I-77, outsourced to Spain, where $13 billion is expected to leave our economy over the 50-year toll lease. But our single spokesperson, our single voter on the CRTPO, voted for the tolls despite that fact. We know this may delay some long-range transportation plans, maybe for a year, two, three, but because it's so expensive over the, you know, those tolls are going to cost us so much money, we feel it's worth stalling the toll thing. So would you appoint somebody to the CRTPO that is a known opponent to tolls?
Dan Klotfelter.
The premise of your question is not correct. It wouldn't just slow things down for a year or two. With an approved transportation improvement plan, the flow of federal funding would stop now. And so the problem that Councilmember Lyles faced was that if she had voted, that the vote was not on the tolls. The vote was whether to approve the state transportation improvement plan. If she had voted no and that plan had stopped, then it wouldn't just have stopped the toll road. It would have stopped the development of all the other projects in the county that we care about a lot. One of the lessons that we've learned about that project is that we got to get ahead of it and not wait around until it's too late, like I'm afraid happened on 77 North. We've been actively meeting right now on the US 74 tolling project and the I-45 tolling project. We do not want to get to the point where we have no options other than to go forward with those projects. So we've been meeting with DOT, state DOT, had a council briefing about a week, I think it was ago, on the toll lane projects, a committee meeting this past Monday. We're not getting the answers we want, and I think those questions should have been asked a lot earlier about I-77 North.
Jennifer.
The only thing I can add to that, I think that we are going to have to look for public-private partnerships as we continue to expand our road system and our transit system. I think that, you know, there is a red line that's supposed to also go up to Mooresville. And we need to look at continuing to work toward how we fund that and how we develop that, because 77 is going to continue to be a challenge. And I would not have supported the toll lanes in the way that they are configured because of the 50-year non-compete clause, which is going to, you know, 50 years from now, we could be three times the size that we are. And for us to constrain our roadway growth for that long, it just doesn't make sense. But I'm a big proponent of helping us find ways to continue to develop the red line.
And both of you are proponents of the streetcar. You've said that it's an economic driver. It's free to ride. How do you know if it's failed? Dan.
How do you know if it's what?
If the streetcar has failed as an economic driver.
Well, if people don't ride it and we don't see redevelopment. I mean, that was the goal that we went into it for. Was to encourage development in the east-west axis and to get ridership. One of the things people don't think about is part of the problem we have with the streetcar right now is the cars we're using. Those, they look a little gimmicky. Those aren't the cars we're going to be using permanently on the line. They're on order. They'll be much more like traditional transit, like the Blue Line transit cars. One of the things people don't realize about a streetcar is it lets us take transit to places that light rail can't go, because we can't put a dedicated rail corridor, and we can't acquire the right-of-way.
But a bus
can go there. Buses have another problem in terms of investment expectations. Buses can be pulled off the street and relocated and rerouted instantly, overnight. A rail is a permanent investment. Property owners along the rail line say, there's going to be transit in that corridor. I can make a commitment to develop in that corridor and know that transit service is going to be there over the long haul. It's not going to move. One of the things people don't think about on a streetcar is if we ever want to have connectivity east and west, And also cross town, for example, say between Eastland Mall and South Park, we're going to have to run it on street. We don't have the ability to build elevated rail lines like we're doing on the Blue Line North right now. So streetcar is actually the only transit option for permanent rail in large parts of the community. Right now, folks, I think, are a little bit too focused on the starter project that we've got and not thinking more long-term about it.
And I also, and, you know, we really don't differ very much on this, but I want to call out that it's a commitment to connecting the east and the west side of our city, which are traditionally underserved areas, that we absolutely need to show that we're bringing jobs and economic development to those parts of town as well. Johnson C. Smith is very motivated for being part of our economic development. Central Avenue out to Eastland very much needs to be part of economic development. If you look at what Central Avenue is doing right now, people know the streetcar line is coming. It also is a connector between the Blue Line and the future Red Line because it goes from the gateway past the arena. That will be the connector for people who are using both of those lines. So one last thing. If you remember, when the Blue Line first started, there was the same little trolley that I know because my son had his 3-year-old birthday party on it. And that was a precursor to the Blue Line. It gave people the image of what transit could look like. It helped people imagine a future with transit. It helped people realize that, oh, if I'm driving my car and I'm stopped by the streetcar, it's not that bad. And so that actually became the Blue Line, which we've seen $1.4 billion of additional investment, $16 million and more for tax revenue. I mean, it has been a tremendous success.
Back to the audience question on I-77, which is a done deal, 50 years of tolls to get on an express lane on I-77 and no expansion of the existing lanes for 50 years, apparently. Independence Boulevard's up next. Do I understand you both correctly in regard to that last question, that you both favor tolls on Independence Boulevard?
No, I do not. Absolutely not. And again, that's what I said in response to the questioner. I want to be sure we get ahead of that issue and don't end up in the box that we're on I-77. I don't think tolls work on a roadway like US 74 in Mecklenburg County. That is a local service road. People get on it at Sharon Amity and they want to get off at Idlewild or Margaret Wallace Road. They're going very short distances because they're using it for local access. The toll concept's not going to work on that kind of roadway. And you look at the design they've got right now from NCDOT on where the access points to the managed lanes would be, you wouldn't be able to use Independence to get on and off at East Way and then go out to Village Lake Drive. You wouldn't be able to do that in the way they've got it structured right now. It's not a workable concept.
Ms. Roberts?
I don't support tolls on 74 either. And again, in looking at options, widening one lane of Independence Boulevard for a mile has cost $150 million. 1 mile of the South Line, $46 million. When we look at transit versus roads, we don't look at the cost side by side. I think we should continue to look at transit going down either Monroe or Independence. There is a rail line there. And again, that we're thinking long term, but we're going to continue to grow and need that. And so I think we should explore those options too.
We have 8 minutes left, so let's do some lightning round questions. Keep the questions short in the audience. Keep the answers short on the stage. And we'll begin over here with an audience question. Welcome.
Jody Collins, I live in South Park. I'd like to know if either one of the candidates is aware that Charlotte is sixth in the nation for human trafficking, specifically sex trafficking, and if you have any specific ideas of how to combat this hideous problem we have.
Dan?
Yes, I am aware of that. That's why we put together legislation about 2 years ago on human trafficking in North Carolina. We had no tools available to our DAs or to our police departments up until 2 years ago in North Carolina. I'm very much aware of that. We've got to set up, I think, a special unit, combined resources, a combined team of DA's office and CMPD, and we've been talking about that exactly.
Jennifer.
We worked on this when I was a commissioner with Ann Tompkins, who was the U.S. attorney at that time, through awareness, through a campaign that talked about domestic violence and sex trafficking and human trafficking. I continue to support Safe Alliance, the nonprofit that runs the shelter. Again, I help build the shelter. I have a volleyball tournament every year that raises money for that organization. And I have served on the Women's Commission. I've also helped start the Women's and Girls Research Alliance at UNC Charlotte, which is looking at getting data on that so that we increase awareness. And I will continue to be a supporter of increasing awareness and addressing this crime.
Okay, over here, please.
Jane Graham from Ballantyne. Can Dan Klotfelter explain his vote to permit semi-automatic weapons in public parks, which led to a AAA rating from the National Rifle Association?
I didn't vote that way.
I read it in the Charlotte Observer.
Ah, well, you
Mark, you want to explain yourself here?
Well, it was
you might want to go read the General Assembly website on that particular bill and look at the vote.
Okay, over here.
Pauline Samuel from Optimist Park. This question is basically to Mayor. There's some issues we've had in Optimist Park that we presented to you in 2014, July the 7th, that hasn't been taken care of. And you all talk about strengthening the communities and working with the communities. We want to know why our issues have not been addressed in our community and why we've been discriminated against.
I'm not sure I know the issue you're addressing in 2014. I'm not sure.
The issue with the sign on the corner of Parkwood and Davidson Street that says Belmont in the middle of Optimist Park, okay, and the red light that we asked for at the corner of 18th and Parkwood for the safety of our community.
Right. The red light determination was they did the study on the red light and determined that the traffic volumes did not warrant a red light. I'm not able to overrule the CDOT engineers on where a red light goes. I think you're right on the sign. I think you're absolutely right on the sign. We need a sign on that corner that really says, should say Belmont on one side, because you're at the corner of two neighborhoods. You're at the intersection of two neighborhoods. And then Optimist Park on the other side of the neighborhood. You folks in Optimist Park, I've noticed in the last year on city council, folks seem to be acting like you don't exist. They act like you're Villa Heights or like you're NoDOT. Even sometimes we had a recent rezoning petition where folks were talking about an area being NoDOT when it really wasn't even in NoDOT. And so, guys, keep speaking up. Keep speaking up.
Lori on Facebook writes, City Council just approved a rezoning project in the Cherry neighborhood despite objections by those living there. Explain your positions on this decision.
There have been a lot of rezonings in Cherry lately. Which do we know which one we're referring to?
No.
Some were
but approved. But it's becoming gentrified.
Some were approved and some were denied. So right. You got to know. There's been there's also been a lot of projects approved for affordable housing in Cherry very recently. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the mix of units in the community right now, we probably have a better income mix than we've had in recent years. The Housing Authority and the Housing Partnership and other nonprofit developers have put a number of new affordable units into Cherry. We've also had some high-end, high-price units put into Cherry. And that's something we haven't had in Cherry in the past. And I think that's what's causing the concern. There have been an awful lot of rezoning votes like in the last 6 months.
You want to comment?
I would just add that I think we need to do a better job of protecting seniors who need to stay in their homes, who are being forced out by some of the development. And also we know that seniors age better in place. And so I think we need to do a better job of preserving the historic nature of some of our neighborhoods.
Looking to the future, both of you, can you, one, answer this question, and two, say what you might do about it? I believe Charlotte is the largest city, has the largest airport in the country that is not connected to the urban core by some kind of rapid transit. You could run the ox cart down there and get there as fast as you could have with a streetcar idea.
I think we need to revisit the 2030 transit plan. There is a plan to have a connection to the airport at some point. Some of the priorities because of growth, because of where the city is now versus where it was when it was originally developed in the late 90s, we need to revisit it, and we need to have community input in doing that and see if that makes sense. I am a big supporter of transit. The challenge is going to be, how do we figure out how to pay for it?
Dan?
Yeah, we recently entered into a memorandum of agreement with NCDOT for the city to take control of the Gateway Station project, which is not going to the airport, but it is the intercity passenger station and the downtown rail connection. That will be the hub from which a line to the airport would go. So we finally got control of that project away from the state and in the hands of the city. I think if we can get that development going, that will be the impetus to start the development of the line out to the airport.
B on Twitter writes, how do you feel about the potential settlement with CMPD officer Randall Carrick since no verdict was reached? Dan?
The settlement was actually with the Farrell family. I think that may be.
I think they may be referring to what the ultimate result of his severance will be.
That is a pending personnel matter. State law says I should not talk about that while it's pending in administrative hearings. So
you're the mayor. You're not the mayor, Jennifer.
I'm going to comply with state law. I'm going to comply with state law.
Jennifer?
I find no reason to disagree with my colleague here.
All right, we have a minute left, so let's go over here very quickly, very quickly.
Barry Sherman, Charlotte, member of One MEC.
As
mayor, what would you do specifically, and how could you collaborate with other civic leaders to address the huge problem of racial and economic segregation in neighborhoods and schools?
10 seconds for each of you. Go ahead, Dan.
I didn't hear the end of the question.
Racial inequality. How would you cooperate with other?
I think that's the greatest challenge facing our city right now, and I think that there are great conversations going on. We need to move past talk and into action. One of the things that I want to do is...
Dan Klotfelder, go ahead.
As I think the questioner knows, one of the things I have done is get him, among others, appointed to the Economic Opportunity Task Force and kick that effort off.
And with that, we are out of time. I want to thank you both for participating, Dan Klotfelder and Jennifer Roberts. I want to thank Mark Washburn for his help and Jen Rothacker from the Charlotte Observer, as well as Tom Bullock from WFAE News. The election is Tuesday. Get out and vote. Thank you all for the